remember I kind of was slated to MC the show, so I kind of went out there and I said something a little bit more controversial than was expected, you know, talking about NRBQ being a band that's pretty much an American institution. And then I kind of segued into, speaking of institutions, some say this band should be in one. And, you know, and then I brought them out. And then the first thing Westerberg says is, "That's enough out of you, Mars." And then they started playing.
That is the voice of Johnny Mars, longtime Chicago DJ. And he was kind of prescient that day, July 4th, 1991, when he introduced the Replacements. Little did he know what would happen later in the concert. He'll talk about that and so much more. Welcome to Rock Conversations. Welcome to the first episode of the second season of Rock Conversations. I am your host, the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll, otherwise known as Rob Bob. So Johnny Mars, if I'm doing my math correctly, has been at WXRT Radio in Chicago for the better part of four decades. Took a little time off in between, sometime in the 90s and maybe into the 2000s. But he's back again. He often does weekend shows, including Saturday Morning Flashback, an incredible show. If ever you get the chance to check it out, either on the radio or online, do so, 9 a.m. till 12 noon. On 93.1 WXRT. So let's get to our rock conversation with Johnny Mars.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
So July 4th, 1991, a beautiful day in Chicago, and you were part of emceeing the Replacements' final show for what, 22 years after that? What was that day like? As you look back, it seems to me it might have been the best of live radio and maybe the worst of live radio.
Well, it was interesting because, you know, we really championed the band. We were really big fans. I remember when I got a copy of Pleased to Meet Me, I thought it was one of the greatest records I'd heard. And I had a pretty crazy interview with the band right before that. In the studio, that was just a debacle. But as far as like that particular show, I remember we all went into it. We went downstairs and we met the band, and Paul was telling us that it was the last show on the tour, and they were really excited. They wanted to play for a couple hours. So we kind of thought that's kind of where we were, and that's where we were going to go. They had expressly asked for NRBQ to be on the bill. They were big fans of that legendary outfit. And a local band who was doing pretty well was the opening act, Material Issue. And they got a pretty good reputation as a national power pop act out of Chicago.
They were great band.
Yeah. Everything was kind of rolling along nicely. We did have a bit of a rain delay. And I remember sitting back, talking to the members of NRBQ. We're all coming up with rain songs, different rain songs. At the, you know, just killing time. And they did their set. And I remember I kind of was slated to MC the show. So I kind of went out there and I said something a little bit more controversial than was expected, you know, talking about NRBQ being a band that's pretty much an American institution. And then I kind of segued into, speaking of institutions, some say this band should be in one. And, you know, and then I brought them out. And then the first thing Westerberg says is, "That's enough out of you, Mars." And then they started playing. And so my deal was, I stayed and I watched a couple of songs, but at the time I was working the night shift. So I had to be on the air that evening at 8 o'clock, and they didn't go on till I think it was like 5:30 or 6. So I basically stayed for a couple of songs. I didn't live too far from Grant Park and I'd ridden my bike there. So I rode home, took a shower, got in the car, and was listening on the way to the station. And all of a sudden, it was a completely different show. They started out strong. They started out with I Will Dare. They kind of rolled into a couple other numbers. I think Can't Hardly Wait was one of them. And it was moving along nicely. And by the time I got in the car driving to the radio station, it had deteriorated into something I didn't know what was going on. And then I just heard the whole thing like fall apart. And then, you know, we find out that that was it. You know, I read Bob Mayer's book And they had already planned that they were going to do that. And that's goodbye for 22 years.
Yeah, I think I heard either live coming back from a gathering that day, or maybe it was replayed over and over. But Frankie Lee, if I recall, was on at the end of the show kind of questioning, you know, did we just see this band disband in front of us?
Correct. And they were actually, Frank, where the DJ stood was off to the side of the stage at the Petrillo band shell. So they were within eyesight of the band. And at some point, Westerberg and Stinson turned to Frank, and Tom Marker was back there doing the MC duties along with Frank. And they were offering their instruments for them to come out and play.
Sweet.
And they just kind of like seemed shocked. They're like, what? No, thank you. So
we're talking with Johnny Mars, longtime fixture of Chicago radio, most of the time at WXRT, where you still are today, weekends and fill-ins during the week. I enjoy listening to you when I'm out biking. Thank God for the internet, right? How would you describe, a loaded question here, but how would you describe XRT, what it means to you, what it means to the other DJs who've worked there over the years, and maybe most importantly, what it means to listeners in Chicago and beyond?
Well, the odd thing about XRT is it started out as this little station on the Northwest side. It was brokered. It was, put together by a couple of guys who came from another radio station that was brokered. And the idea was to model it on the classical radio station of the day, which is still around, WFMT, which was Chicago's fine arts station. So WXRT became Chicago's fine rock station. And it was on initially midnight to 5, I believe, and there were just three DJs. And it just grew from there. In 1976, it went full time. I had picked up on it when it was broadcasting from about 3 in the afternoon. And I just thought that it presented music in a way that I wanted to hear. And apparently there was a cult of listeners that wanted to hear it that way as well. And that was taking everything, that was out there from all the different genres and kind of putting it together in an artistic way that was kind of like put together or brought together by the disc jockey and what they brought to the table, you know, their eccentricities, their tastes. And when the station grew and we continued that format, it was like 4 or 5 different program directors each doing a show. So your tastes would kind of be part of the whole presentation. Yep. And I always thought that was exceptional, that there were personalities and there was also an unlimited amount of music. So you would hear how things evolved, what things came from, the influences, and how it all blended together. And back then, you know, when I started in 1980, it was unheard of to let the DJs program all the music and to let them take and pick. You know, you'd start with your first record and you wouldn't know what your third record was going to be until you got there. So very stream of consciousness, spoken word. You could start a set with a piece of music and then blend into some spoken word and then go into 4 or 5 different songs and then come back to the final part of the first song that you played. So it was very open to all sorts of artistic impressions. And I think from that, you know, the station grew. And of course, as things became more successful, there became more demands on making it more streamlined. You know, there was a kind of a push to make it, how do you keep the integrity of the radio station yet make it more commercial, yet grow the audience, you know, to make it less of an elitist thing, to be less snobby, to be more inclusive. And I think that was always the challenge of XRT. But, you know, we did it, and the people that were there sort of became family. It's unheard of for disc jockeys to remain at a radio station for the terms that we've been there. My full-time employment there lasted 21 years, and then I left for 6 years, and now I've been back part-time and fill-in for about 14 years. I mean, that's just unheard of, you know?
So I'm the master of unfair questions. I'm going to ask one, but it's got a positive – hopefully a positive theme to it. If you were to pick one other DJ at XRT, who who's your favorite, either on air or off the air? Who would it be and why?
Well, I kind of had a couple that I really liked when I was a listener. I always liked Scott McConnell. I thought his sense of humor was pretty dry. And it sounded like when he was the morning man, and I think he was the first official morning man of the radio station when it went 24 hours. He sounded like a lot of people felt in the morning at the time. But he had a dry sense of humor, and he had an exquisite taste in music. And so I liked what he did. And then the other would be a guy that's become a close friend of mine, Bobby Scafish. I always appreciated his wit and his taste, and also the fact that he was on the cutting edge and introduced a number of artists to the radio station that, you know, we hadn't been playing, and kind of brought that whole punk element and new wave element into the radio station and helped us, you know, solidify that side of the audience.
I love Scafish. Was there a period that you look back at now at XRT that really stands out, whether it was for the music, for the on-air personalities, whatever it might be? Can you identify maybe a 3 or 4 year period?
I think, you know, when I started in 1980, I was kind of like, it was one of those weird things that, like, I got what I wanted. Now what? And it was like, you know, I was a little freaked out, like, oh, now I got to go in and do it. And I wasn't, you know, I was a little bit self-conscious about whether I was up to the task. But, you know, I fell into it. I really started enjoying it. And I think the station was starting to flourish. And then, you know, Scafish left, I think, in 83. And I was kind of pushed into doing his shift 6 to 10. And I enjoyed that for a while. But I also had a lot of personal problems I was dealing with. And those came to a head in 87 when I quit my drinking and drugging ways. And from that point forward, from 87 till like the early 90s, mid 90s, I thought those were the best years of the radio station's life. We hit peaks with the audience. We were still diverse, yet we were also playing the game of radio, and we were keeping to our, you know, idea of being eclectic but commercial at the same time. And I think the audience grew with us tremendously at that point. And everything was going along well, and then the station got sold in 1996. Yeah. And then when it got sold, that began a transformation that you know, a lot of us were unsure of. And, you know, we had overlords that lived, you know, and worked in New York. The guy that owned the radio station for the beginning, you know, from 72 till 95, 96, when it was sold, had a corner office. So if there were any gripes or any thoughts or any ideas, you can go into his office and talk to him. From 96 on, you know, we kind of really didn't know who was calling the shots.
We don't have to relive your personal struggles, but did I recall reading once that you were nicknamed the Mound of Sound or something like that?
Yeah, Scafish gave me that name, the Round Mound of Sound. I was I was a pretty big guy. I was roughly 300 pounds, and I was into a lot of different things that weren't really good for me.
I recall you kind of turned that around, right? Got into biking and other things?
I got into biking, running, exercise, but mainly what helped is I quit my old bad habits. And once you do that, you kind of have to find other things to do to make up all the time that you wasted doing the wrong things. And one thing led to another, and I lost a lot of weight. I changed my diet. I started exercising, and I found that I really liked it. So I became an avid runner. And then a biker, and I'm still at it, but you know, with a lot less vim and vigor. I don't run much anymore. My legs don't do it, but I do a lot of walking with the dog, and I also do a lot of indoor biking on the on the trainer.
Excellent. Johnny Mars is our guest on Rock Conversations. I want to go back to 1980. I think you said the year you started at XRT, and bring up Scafish once again. He told me you guys went back to back on the air, obviously for many years, but the night that John Lennon was killed, he was in the midst of a regular show, if I recall. And so by the time you hit the airwaves, it was, I'm guessing, time to pay tribute to Lennon, something Skafish couldn't really do because of the advertising commitments to that 9 to 10 program. I think it was 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. What was that night like for you?
It was a night I'll never forget. And when I bring it up, it reminds me of how connected and how raw this whole thing was, and how, you know, we put a lot of artifice on, you know, we're broadcasters and you're listeners. And, you know, that night broke that all down. You know, Skafish was doing a show called This Week in Chicago, which was a sponsored show about events that were happening in the city for that given 7-day period. And then he broke the news at about 9:45. Something came over the wire, and he handed it to me that John Lennon was shot. And then he went back in the wire room, came out, and it was like, John Lennon's dead. And then 5 minutes later, I'm on the air. And so here I was, you know, having gone on the air March of 1980, and here it's, you know, 9 months later, and I'm still sort of a rookie in my rookie year, and I've got the weight of this on me. Yeah. So I just instinctively took calls from people, and everybody was crying, and everybody was, you know, stunned and didn't want to believe it. And then I just played appropriate mournful music that fit the sphere of the night. And, you know, I was really wrung out by the time I got through with it, that I was on from 10 to 2, and just emotionally drained from, you know, the weight of having to carry that across, being the first person to kind of bring that to the public. And, you know, I didn't think, you know, I mean, I can't remember anything but just raw, pure emotion and, you know, feeling like everything's changing now. You know, that this is the first rock and roll assassination, and where do we go from here?
Was there any news event that came close, that broke while you were on the air in your career, where you wanted to react with music, you wanted to react with callers perhaps, or just reflect on it yourself?
I don't think there was anything of that magnitude, but I was on the air when Jeff Buckley died. I was on the air a couple of years ago when Lou Reed died. You know, there've been other people whose deaths I've had to report, but nothing with the kind of impact that, you know, a cultural icon like John Lennon had, and especially in the way that he was killed. You know, it just didn't make any sense to people, and kind of shattered that illusion of, like, you know, that hippie idea and, you know, peace and love and everything that he was championing and believed in was, you know, ended that night. So it was raw. It was emotional. It was, as I said, very draining by the time I got done. I really, it was mostly a blur. I was just operating on instinct, like, you know, one record leading to the next, and, you know, just trying to find all the appropriate music that I felt could convey the mood. And, when I left, I really, you know, I didn't know what if I did a good job or not. And I remember I got some write-up in the Chicago Reader a week later about, you know, how I handled it, and that it was a well-written piece. So
let's move to a more lighter note, if we could. Sure. I didn't know this until a couple of years ago, when The Loop was sold and they were going to shut down, you know, the rock and roll format. They did a story and you were quoted in the Chicago Tribune. I didn't realize you had been an intern with Frankie Lee at The Loop, but it kind of made sense because I heard you reference a few weeks ago how the two of you were first exposed, I think, in one of the studios at The Loop to this band from Pasadena, California, known as Van Halen. What was that moment like when you first heard Van Halen?
That was pretty wild. Frank and I met at Columbia College, and that was in the fall of 76. He had 2 years at a school, and I was coming off of having left a college after a semester. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but I did get involved with the radio station for the brief time I was at this university. And I thought that's maybe the way I should go. I took a class in the summer at Columbia College. Was, you know, kind of suggested that I go back in the fall for full classes. And that's where I met Frank. We got internships at the Loop in the December of 76, as the Loop was going to transition. There used to be a station called WSDM, and they were owned by the Chess family of Chess Records, and they were going to transition to a new format called the Loop. Now, this isn't the Loop that you knew with Steve Dahl and the black t-shirts. This was kind of a more friendlier Loop. It was a rock station, but it wasn't as aggressive as the Loop became when they hired Dahl. So Frank and I met there, and one of the production guys, great guy, Dave Logan, ended up being a pioneer at XM Radio and has programmed a number of radio stations in his time. He was the production guy, and he had the Van Halen record. And I remember he called us in, and he played Eruption through the speakers, which, you know, in a radio station, they're pretty state of the art, and yeah, put it on at the loudest possible volume that you can imagine. And Frank and I remember were just standing there stunned that, what is this guy playing? And who is this guy? You know? And then we got to see him. They did the station's 1 year birthday party at a place, a small club in Schaumburg called Beginnings, and got to see him play up close. And that was when Eddie Van Halen was playing with his back to the audience, 'cause I think he thought people were going to steal his licks and whatnot. So yeah, it was pretty, pretty amazing moment.
I was fortunate enough to see them. Oh, I lose track of when, probably 2016. It was kind of high school graduation present to my older son. And we saw him in St. Paul, and David Lee Roth was with them. I think it was shortly before they then postponed the rest of the tour. But from our vantage point, stage left and up a little bit, they were great that night. Other people who saw the show thought they were horrible, but I thought they were, you know, given their age and everything, I thought they were fantastic. And I'm not even a huge Van Halen fan, but I certainly enjoyed the show.
Yeah, I'm not a huge Van Halen fan either, because like I said, that when I mentioned them on that flashback, they were pretty much kind of a bar band from Pasadena, except they had this incredible guitar player who basically was doing stuff that nobody had ever heard of before. And that's, I think, what was the drive that made them so great. And they, you know, they didn't have the greatest songs. They had, you know, they had catchy songs, certainly. But I think the thing was, as a cohesive unit, they were good, but Eddie Van Halen took them like to places, you know, that they would never have gone without him.
Without question. Are there any other artists that you remember the first time you heard them and thought, wow, this band or this individual artist really has potential?
Well, the one that comes to mind is Prince. When one of the to extend the internship, Frank and I ended up staying at the Loop for a couple of years. Frank ended up graduating and then was sent to a radio station in El Paso, Texas, where the people that were programming the Loop also were consulting the station. And so Frank went down there in the summer of 76. I was asked to go on the air the summer of 78. Sorry. I was asked to go on the air part-time at the Loop, which I thought was great. I could, you know, use this as resume material. I could continue and finish school. And then the fall came around and they sent me down to Texas. So we were both down in Texas, and I became the music director, and Frank was the afternoon DJ there and assistant program director. So we would get all the records from the record companies. And one day we got this record, and it said Prince, and there was a guy on the front. It was his second album. And we thought, oh, here's an interesting looking guy. And then we flipped the album on the back, and there's a guy riding a horse with wings. And we're like, what is this? What is this? So we thought it was a joke. So we put the record on, and we were completely blown away by his guitar playing. We're like, what the heck is this? And then we started hearing, we didn't play it because we were pretty much a hardcore rock station, but we started hearing I Want to Be Your Lover on the top 40 stations around, and all of a sudden that gained traction. So cut to a couple years later, I'm in Chicago and I'm working at XRT, and one of the things that we did on a regular basis was have weekly music meetings, and we were asked to bring in some recordings, new music that we liked that we could play and champion at the meeting, get our other colleagues to get on board too. So I remember Prince's Dirty Mind came out, and I heard it, and I remembered from the second album and what I heard, and this one was just an extension. It knocked me out. And I brought Prince's Dirty Mind, and I remember Donna Summer's Hot Stuff at this music meeting. And I played both, and I said, we got to play both these records. And the music director at the time looked at me and said, you know what it'd be like if we played Donna Summer on this radio station, given that Steve Dahl had just blown up disco records a few years earlier at Comiskey Park. So we never gave a chance to Donna Summer, which I'm still kind of mad about, but we did give a shot to Prince. And certainly, you know, When You Were Mine was basically a rock song, you know, yeah. And we played When You Were Mine, and then we played Dirty Mind, and the record took off. And I remember seeing him at Park West when he had the three other guys, Des Dickerson, and it was not much of a visual show as far as lights and theatrics go, but they had choreography. And this is back in the days when, you know, Prince was dressing like the album cover of Dirty Mind, where he's wearing, you know, Speedos and leg warmers.
Now, that was a cute look, wasn't it?
Yeah. And the trench coat, you know, and, but he was amazing. He was amazing. I stayed for both shows. He played Park West in Chicago, small club. And I just became like a big champion, and I would never miss a show. I remember seeing him, and I drove out to Rockford to see him, saw him at the auditorium theater, any place he played, we would go see him for like the first 5 or 6 years. And, you know, it all kind of coalesced for him with the, you know, Purple Rain record a few years down the road. And as gigantic as that became with the movie, in conjunction with the movie, it was spectacular. So yeah, I think Prince is another guy that I would say I had a hand in helping. Not that I did much, but I got to play him on the radio on a rock station, which I think to this day, XRT gets credited as the only commercial rock station to play Prince when that record came out.
Interesting. I'll confess, I only saw him once, and I was left just amazed at his energy. It never ended. He was bouncing all over the stage for 90% of the show. A couple times he sat down to play some slower songs just by himself, but he was fantastic. Let's stick, if we could, with the little Minnesota theme. As we record this, it is Bob Dylan's 80th birthday. Are you a Dylan fan?
Huge Dylan fan. I've loved him since I was, you know, in my teens. You know, just a historic figure, a guy who, you know, continues to change the game and make valid and important music, and has you know, stuff to say about our situation and our condition, and, you know, is mysterious, and you know, I'm sure he's got a lot of reason to be, because, you know, people were picking through his garbage cans way back when. I'll tell you a quick story. I got to meet him at the first Farm Aid. I went down there. It was in Champaign, Illinois, 86, I believe. And for some reason, I finagled a backstage pass, and I was kind of wandering, and I was in the performers area. And, you know, I was pretty much starstruck by everybody that was around me. And there, out of nowhere, is Dylan sitting on a trailer stoop with a number of musicians around him. And he's smoking a cigarette, and I went up to him, and I got my backstage pass signed by him. It was just sort of a scrawl, and he kind of like blew me off and started talking to somebody else. And I just kind of slunk back and watched, and he flicked his cigarette butt. And I watched as two or three people around me kind of sauntered over to where the cigarette butt was.
Pick it up.
I mean, that's that guy's world, you know? And so I can imagine the security and the secrecy that he revolves around because of being Bob Dylan. So it's a blessing and a curse, I imagine, to him, but it's certainly a blessing to all of us that we got to live in his time and hear all the music that he's made. And through the years, I've gotten to MC. I got to MC a Chicago, United Center show where Joni Mitchell was the opening act some years ago. I got to MC him at the Aragon. And, you know, the thing is, you have to meet with his representatives, and they have to hear what you're going to say. Usually nobody kind of edits what you say up on stage, But with Dylan, you have to kind of tell them kind of what you're going to say. And they tell you things that you can't say. You can't call them the bard.
Okay. I'm guessing your intro to The Replacements might not have been accepted by Dylan's people. Over.
Well, I would have never said he belonged in an institution. But go ahead.
Yeah, the back to Farm Aid just for a second. I mean, what a remarkable night that was. I remember watching it on TV. I think Dylan came out and played Maggie's Farm, among other things. What other memories do you have from that night? As you mentioned, you know, starstruck is probably a good way to describe it. But the music, I thought, was pretty strong, too.
The music was strong, but it was not one of those nights that I can remember vividly, because I remember having that backstage pass to the performers area. And for some reason, I watched a lot of the show on TV and never got into the stadium to watch the show. Partly because I was really sort of taken with, like, you know, I'd stand in line to get food and behind me would be Willie Nelson and in front of me would be Ricky Lee Jones. And I'd be like, what the heck is going on? So most of the show I really watched from the TV monitors in the performers area. So
Johnny Mars, longtime fixture of Chicago radio, most of the that time spent at WXRT. In our remaining minutes, I want to move through just a couple things, kind of a best and a worst. And you kind of helped tip me off. Warren Zevon, who I loved. I think you said he was one of the better interviews, if not one of the best that you ever did. Was that you would have been at XRT. I'm pretty certain, right?
Los Lobos came in and I had elaborately prepared and asking questions and they would answer with yes or no answers. You know, the nightmare of any interviewer.
Yes.
And so I got through that. And then I thought, well, now I got Warren Zevon and I didn't really prepare that much. And he was there to promote Sentimental Hygiene and he walked in and we shook hands and I, mentioned some people we had in common and he just sat down and it was like one of the easiest, most fun interviews I had with anybody. He just was a really nice guy. And apparently it rubbed off with him. The next day we got together and hung out. And I remember he came back in December to play a concert and he called me up. Somehow he got the hotline number and he invited me to the concert because it was his girlfriend's birthday and he was going to have, some people come by and hang out and celebrate her, her birthday. And so I went down there. I was kind of flabbergasted. And since that moment, I'd gone to see him on a regular basis. And as time passed, he got a little bit more ornery, wasn't exactly as nice a guy, but, and I don't know what he was going through or anything like that, but those first, the initial interview and then hanging out with him and being surprised that he would call me and remember me to invite me to his girlfriend's birthday party was something,
That is
special.
Pretty cool. You know, we were talking about Prince earlier. I'm sure you remember from the movie Purple Rain, First Avenue. And mm-hmm. I think I saw Zevon there three or four times within about a 3 or 4 year stretch. And each time he delivered, he was great live. And what a magical piano player, keyboards player.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I got the chance to see him before he quit drinking. He put out the Excitable Boy
that was
record.
Fun.
Yeah. He put out the Excitable Boy record and then he played. This is when I was still interning at the Loop. And he played Park West, a nice, by maybe 600, 800 seater in Chicago's Lincoln Park. And boy, he killed it. He was unbelievable. He was out of his mind and crazed. And he had that great band with him that included Waddy Wachtel, a lot of the people that were on the record, and just was an amazing night.
On the flip side, I think you had an in-studio performance with XTC that maybe didn't go as well as possible.
Yeah, it was one of those things where, they asked me to interview them. They were going to be playing. They were going to do, Andy Partridge was notorious for having stage fright, which is weird because when I first got to the radio station, we had just started playing, not Drums and Wires, the record that Black Sea, the record that came after that. And they had booked a show to play at the University of Illinois and Skafish was going to DJ, and it was kind of like a really, you know, it was like a long lunch room where they played. It wasn't even a concert room of any type. And I got to see him up close, and they were great, and they had no problem. But apparently, years later, he, you know, got stage fright. If you saw that documentary on them, it turned out that he had a Valium habit.
Probably, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, there's a documentary on XTC that's really good. You know, that kind of was maybe the reason that he couldn't be on stage. But again, whatever, he wasn't playing live. So they had decided to do this radio station tour where the band would play live in the studio and be interviewed. And so I was asked to do it. We did it in the studios on Belmont Avenue. And I didn't realize that they were going to invite people from, you know, the sales staff would get to invite some clients.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Music people would be there. So it was like all of a sudden there was an audience there. And I maybe wasn't wholly prepared. And I wasn't really thinking that it would be anything more than me just, you know, saying, hey, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. Why don't you play us some songs? And it was built in with an interview, and you know, it went okay. Andy Partridge was more of a wise ass than I anticipated, which, you know, again, my fault, I should have realized. But you know, he was not difficult to talk to, but he was always being, he was being a little bit challenging. And at any rate, what ended up happening is they played and they sounded great. And one of the songs was used for the first on XRT Live from the Archives disc, a charity series of charity discs that we did through the years. And the medley of a few songs from that interview were on that disc, saved for eternity. So you didn't, you get to hear me just a little bit at the end, you know, but none of the interview. So it wasn't my finest moment, just like the Replacements wasn't my finest moment.
Okay, a couple quick ones before we wrap up. And again, I, as I said before, sometimes I ask unfair questions, like name your favorite Chicago-based or Illinois-based band.
I would say I would go back to John Prine, who's really, you know, unfortunately we lost him last year with due to COVID, but
right.
Certainly one of the smartest and most, you know, observant songwriters that we've ever known. I mean, you talk about Dylan, you know, Prine was in a different class and just as good, I thought, but didn't quite get the notoriety and, you know, didn't hit the zeitgeist like Dylan did when everything changed. But John Prine certainly fits the bill. That's probably the main one. As far as like rock bands, hard to say. You're kind of putting me on the spot.
I know. I told you I was unfair.
Yeah,
we can move on.
Yeah.
Favorite Beatles album. Do you have a favorite? I know there are many great Beatles albums.
Probably Revolver.
I'm with you.
Probably Revolver. My favorite album of all time, I have to mention, because it just turned 55, is Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys. And I came upon that record late. But it's still one of those mind-boggling records that, you know, I connect with and still seems timeless to me. And a record that kind of straddles the kind of generations, that it was the record that came out that inspired the Beatles to put together Sgt. Pepper. They were challenged by it. And it also is a record that inspires all these kids that are in indie bands of the last 10, 15 years. They still see it as a touchstone. So for a record to be able to have that kind of power and that kind of draw is pretty amazing.
And you, if I'm not mistaken, emceed a performance with the CSO and Brian Wilson, right?
Wasn't the CSO, it was an orchestra that they put together that performed Pet Sounds. There was a time when, you know, everybody sort of saw what Pet Sounds was as this cultural touchstone. And, he performed it a number of times. I've seen him do it at the House of Blues, at the Chicago Theater with an orchestra. And I got to MC that, which was kind of like a great thing. And I had met him. The first time I met him was on 8/8/88, which was the date of the first Cubs night game, supposed to be the first Cubs night game. but it was rained out. So the actual first Cubs night game was the next night. But he came into the studio. He was promoting the Love and Mercy record. And I remember standing next to him in Lynn's office. Lynn Bramer was the music director at the time. And I liked the record. And I kind of casually mentioned to him that I liked one particular song. And he turned to me and he just said, "Oh, yeah, that's a really great song," like that. And I went, "Ooh, okay." And, you know, this was at a time when he was under Dr. Landy. He was heavily medicated. And, you know, he had a guy following him around and kind of was Dr. Landy's sort of operative with him. And I didn't envy Frank to interview him that day. He put him on the air that afternoon. But, yeah, Brian Wilson's, you know, I'm glad he's still in the world. And I'm glad he gave us what he gave us.
Cubs fan or Sox fan? You.
Cubs fan. I don't dislike the Sox. I'm an appreciator of the Sox, and I always wish them well, and they have a great team this year. But I grew up as a Cubs fan, and you know, my allegiance has always been with the Northside team, and you know, all the frustrations that come with that. And you know, I think the majority of the people on the staff align with the Cubs. There's a couple that don't, but that's okay.
We'll allow that once in a while. We Cubs fans. Yeah. Well, this has been great. Before we wrap, I got to tell you, you know, DJs like you are so sometimes so witty, right? You get a short amount of time to be on the air and you throw in these great lines. And for some reason they stick, you know, people like you, Skayfish, the others I've listened to for years. And one of your favorite lines, I'll never forget. I think I was driving back from South Bend with my wife. And you said, came on to introduce a song and said, "Do you do a padiddle about a song about one headlight?" And I thought that was one of the funniest damn things.
Well, thanks.
It's neither here nor there, but it still sticks with me. This has been great talking.
Thank you very much, Rob. I appreciate it. I had a good time, too. Thank you very much for asking. I'm honored.